The lawyer on the phone now said he had a friend who had been approached to go to work for the Nixon campaign in a very unusual way. Bernstein put a sheet of paper in the typewriter and began taking it down. The caller said his friend was named Alex Shipley, an assistant attorney general of the state of Tennessee, living in Nashville. In the summer of 1971, Shipley had been asked by an old army buddy to join the Nixon campaign. Essentially, the proposal was that there was to be a crew of people whose job it would be to disrupt the Democratic campaign during the primaries. This guy told Shipley there was virtually unlimited money available. The caller didn't know the name of the man who had approached Shipley. This guy was a lawyer. The idea was to travel around. There would be some going to towns and waiting for things to happen. For instance, some guy would be waiting to see if the Democratic candidates were renting a hall to have a rally. Then his job would be to call up the owner of the hall and say the event had been rescheduled, to fuck up the logistics. Shipley had told the story during a drunken conversation at a picnic, and the caller didn't remember many other details. At the time Shipley was approached, he was still in the Army, stationed in Washington. He had talked to people who had worked for former Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee. They advised him to lead this guy along while trying to figure out what was going on. The caller didn't know what had happened after that. Reluctantly, he gave Bernstein his name and telephone number, on the condition that he never be disclosed as the source of the information. Bernstein thanked him and asked him to stay in touch. Bernstein got Alex Shipley's number from Nashville Information, but there was no answer. The next day, Bernstein showed Howard Simons his notes and said he was convinced the information, admittedly very sketchy, was important. By itself, the Watergate bugging made little sense, particularly since it had occurred when the Nixon campaign was at its strongest. But if it had been part of something much broader, it might make some sense, Bernstein said. And there was evidence of a broader scheme, though the information was disparate. Among the things they were aware of had been the attempt to bug McGovern headquarters, Hunt's investigation of Teddy Kennedy, an investigation by McCord of Jack Anderson, the effort by Baldwin to infiltrate the Vietnam veterans against the war, Hunt's investigation of leaks to the news media, and McCord's rental of an office next to Muskie's campaign headquarters. Perhaps the White House had been in the political intelligence business in a much bigger way and for much longer than most people figured. Watergate could have been scheduled before the president's re-election chances looked so good, and perhaps someone had neglected to pull the plug. Simons was interested and urged Bernstein to get to Shipley fast. The managing editor shared Bernstein's fondness for doping things out on the basis of sketchy information. At the same time, he was cautious about what eventually went into print. On more than one occasion, he told Bernstein and Woodward to consider delaying his story, or, if necessary, to pull it at the last minute if they had any doubts. "I don't care if it's a word, a phrase, a sentence, a paragraph, a whole story, or an entire series of stories," he said. "When in doubt, leave it out." A prize-winning science reporter, Simons had become the number two editor at the Post a year before. An intent, sensitive man with a large nose, thin face, and deep-set eyes, he looks like the kind of Harvard teaching assistant who carries a slide rule strapped to his belt. But he is skillful with fragile egos, and also the perfect counterpoint to Bradley. Bradley is more like Woodward. He wants hard information first and is impatient with theories. Bernstein tried to stir Woodward's interest in Shipley's story, but Woodward was skeptical. That night, Bernstein reached Shipley at home. He sounded pleasant and was surprised that a reporter would be so interested in the approach that had been made to him. "The deal I was offered was slick," Shipley said. "We'd say we were working for so-and-so and the Democrats, and really we'd be working for Nixon. Say, for instance, my job would be to go to a Kennedy rally. I'd say to one of Kennedy's people, 'I'm also with you people. We want you to go get a job in the Muskie office. And when you find out anything, you let me know and we'll get it back to Kennedy.'" Somewhere Bernstein had been told that the CIA did that kind of thing abroad. He had heard it called mindfuck, but the agency called it black operation. Shipley continued. There would be as much money as needed. I was promised the pie in the sky, by and by. Expenses plus salary. I'd be working for him. Shipley didn't want to give the man's name until he decided to tell the whole story. I've been thinking about talking to somebody. About 6 months ago, I made a memo to myself, and it's up at the office. I've got dates. Now, I'll give you the best of my memory. First, however, he wanted to obtain permission from his boss before talking to the press. He thought his boss would approve. The Attorney General of Tennessee was a Democrat, and so was Shipley. That was perhaps the strangest aspect of the approach in Shipley's mind. This guy came to me. I said, I'm a man with a picture of Franklin Roosevelt on the wall since I've been a child. Why me? He said, it could be for purely selfish reasons. We can do a lot for you. Liking the Democrats more, I didn't follow up. Beyond the man's word, Shipley had no proof that the offer was made on behalf of Richard Nixon's re-election campaign. He had known the man in the army. My impression was that he would not be very effective at spy stuff, but he said he was working for Nixon. Bernstein didn't want to press for the recruiter's name. Yet. He called Shipley the next evening. The Democratic Attorney General of Tennessee told Shipley to do what he thought right, and Shipley had gotten his notes together. The man who had approached him was named Donald Segretti. The first time he called would have been 26 June, 1971. He had called and told me he would be in Washington, and he came to a dinner party at my apartment on 26 June. Nothing was said that night. On 27 June, I met him for breakfast. That's when he first mentioned the deal. He asked would I be interested, because I was getting out of the army. Both of us were getting out shortly. We were all captains in the Judge Advocate General Corps. None of us had anything lined up. He told me he had come to Washington for an interview at the Treasury Department. Bernstein wrote a note to himself. Treasury. Liddy. Gordon Liddy had worked at Treasury before he joined the White House staff, at just about the time Shipley was talking about. But Shipley said he had never heard of Liddy before the Watergate break-in. Shipley had picked Segretti up at the Georgetown Inn the morning of June 27, 1971, and driven him to Dulles Airport. On the way to Dulles, he said, "How would you like to work in an operation doing a little political espionage?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "For instance, we go to a Kennedy rally and find an ardent Kennedy worker. Then you say that you're a Kennedy man, too, but you're working behind the scenes. You get them to help you. You send them to work for Muskie, stuffing envelopes or whatever. And you get them to pass you the information. They'll think that they're helping Kennedy against Muskie, but actually you're using the information for something else." It was very strange. About three-quarters of the way to the airport, I said, "Well, who would we be working for?" He said, "Nixon." I was really taken aback because all the actions he had talked about would have taken place in the Democratic primaries. The main purpose was that the Democrats not have the ability to get back together after a knockdown, drag-out campaign, he said. What we want to do is cause enough havoc so they can't. I said, "Well, it sounds interesting. Let me think about it." The following week, Segretti had called Shipley from Fort Ord, California, to renew the offer. "On Thursday, 1 July, Shipley continued, "I went and had an interview with a friend who had worked for Senator Albert Gore as administrative assistant and asked him what I should do. I told him I wasn't interested, but I was wondering if it might help the Democrats if I played along or whether I should drop it immediately. He said, 'Don't stick your neck out, but don't say no. See what you can find out.' On the 19th of July, Segretti called and asked that I think of five names of people that I might contact to join the operation. I don't recall if I told him any or not. On Sunday morning, the 25th of July, he called me from Chicago and said he had made a similar proposal to another Army captain there, Roger Lee Nixt, who was stationed at an Army post in Chicago, 5th Army headquarters, I think. He said he wanted to fly to Washington to talk to me. The gist of that conversation was, 'Are you with me or not?' I asked him what he wanted me to do. He said, enlist people. Be imaginative. One thing he did stress was asking people who were fairly free to travel. And he was asking lawyers because he stressed he didn't want to do anything illegal. It wasn't represented as a strictly strong-arm operation. He stressed what fun we could have. He said that when a rally was scheduled for 7 p.m. at a local coliseum, you would call up and represent that you were the field manager for the candidate, and you had information that some rowdies, hippies, or what have you, were going to cause trouble. So you asked him to postpone the rally from 7 o'clock, when it was actually scheduled, to 9 o'clock, thereby ensuring that the coliseum manager had the place padlocked when the candidate showed up. Then again, on July 28th, Segretti had called Shipley and had asked him to fly to Atlanta to help enlist another former Army captain, Kenneth Griffiths. Shipley didn't go. The last time Shipley heard from Segretti was on October 23rd, 1971. He called from California and asked me to check into Muskie's operation in Tennessee. All these times he would give me these proposals, I would say sure, but I just never did anything about it. Did Shipley know where to get in touch with Segretti, where he lived? About 2 weeks ago, I tried to get a phone number in Los Angeles for him, but there was no listing. He told me he was going to be in a law firm by the name of Young and Segretti. He said it was a cover, that he would be doing only political work. Shipley had finished going through his notes. Bernstein asked him to try to recall his conversations with Segretti in more detail. At one time, Segretti said it might be good to get a false ID to travel under, that it would be harder for anyone to catch up with us. He mentioned he might use the pseudonym Bill Mooney for himself. Just in passing, he said, why don't you think up a good one and get an ID card? I said, I'm not particularly good at that kind of thing. He also told me we would be taken care of after Nixon's re-election. I would get a good job in the government. I said, how in hell are we going to be taken care of if no one knows what we're doing? And Segretti said, Nixon knows that something is being done. It's a typical deal. Don't tell me anything, and I won't know. How sure was Shipley that Segretti was working for the Nixon campaign? I don't know if he ever worked for Nixon, he said. I don't have any proof. He could have been working for Kennedy, Muskie, or Sam Yorty, for all I know. But Segretti had told Shipley that if he stayed with the operation, it would lead to a permanent job in the administration. Bernstein asked whether Shipley knew of others Segretti had approached. Peter Dixon, an attorney in San Francisco. All the people whose names I listed were in Vietnam together, as Army captains in JAG in 68 and 69. Nixt is working for a law firm in Denison, Iowa, I think. Griffiths is still in Atlanta. What other details could he remember? Well, Segretti said that the people who contacted him about the operation were Los Angeles people. They could have been law school people, old friends of the family. I have no idea. He never told me any names. He said, that's the way we'll operate. I was not to tell him the names of any operatives working for me. He said he wanted to cover the country. Frankly, I don't think he could do it because he's not that kind of guy. He doesn't have the right personality. He's a small guy with a big smile on his face all the time. Naive. Bernstein asked for a physical description of Segretti. Short, baby-faced, less than 5'8", maybe 150 pounds. Shipley didn't know much about Segretti's politics. I always assumed he was fairly liberal. I don't think we ever had a political discussion. Segretti had said that he would more or less be the head coordinator of the operation for the whole country. But a lot of the things he proposed to do didn't seem that damaging. He said we could get a post office box in Massachusetts in the name of the Massachusetts Safe Driving Committee and award a medal to Teddy Kennedy. One thing that struck me was that he seemed to be well-financed. He was always flying across the country. He said that money was no problem, that the people he would be working for wanted results for the cash that would be spent. Shipley had pressed him on the financing, but Segretti had said, don't ask me any names because I'm not going to tell you any. I had the feeling it was some big spender, but not a government man. Bernstein asked Shipley not to discuss the information with anyone else, and called Woodward at home. They were on the way, Bernstein said. It would take a few days, but the story was in sight. This time Woodward was intrigued. Kenneth Griffiths, Roger Lee Nixt, and Peter Dixon all had listed phone numbers. Nixt didn't want to talk about it. "I had just one conversation about it with Don. He's a friend, and I'm just not going to discuss it, out of consideration for him. I didn't do anything. Yes, he proposed some undercover work for the Nixon campaign, but I'm not going to talk about it." At Griffith's home in Atlanta, there was no reply. That left Dixon in San Francisco. His secretary said he was on a camping trip, but was expected to arrive that afternoon in Reno, Nevada, at the home of a friend, Paul Bible. "The senator's son?" asked Bernstein. "Yes." That was great. Senator Allen Bible of Nevada and his family had lived next door to the Bernstein family in Silver Spring, Maryland, for more than a dozen years. Paul was a few years older than Bernstein, but they knew each other, had played street football together. He remembered when Paul had gotten his 58 Chevy Impala. It was jet black, lowered, and had dual exhausts and spinners. Bernstein had been envious. He called Bible in Reno and told him what he was working on. He was sure Paul would help. Bible was flabbergasted. Segretti? He couldn't imagine it. Bible, too, had served in the army with Segretti, and Don wasn't the type of guy to get into this kind of mess. He would have Dixon call back and meanwhile gave Bernstein the names of other officers who had served in Segretti's outfit. Dixon called from Bible's house. "Don called and asked if I'd be interested in doing some work for the re-election of the president. I said, 'Gee, Don, I'm not interested in political matters. I'm not a Republican anyway.' He didn't go into it any further." Two acknowledgments. Bernstein reached Griffiths after two more tries. He didn't want to talk about his dealings with Segretti. They had lunched together, had talked about the campaign. Segretti had tried to recruit him to do something for the president. The word undercover or underground had come up. He didn't remember which. "I said that, much as I'd like to do something for the president, I didn't have time to do more than send him a contribution." Between calls, Bernstein tried to find a number for Donald Segretti. There was no such listing in Los Angeles. There was no law firm listed under Young and Segretti. There were several Segrettis, however. After several calls, Bernstein reached Mrs. A.H. Segretti in Culver City. She said she was Don's mother. Bernstein bent the rules a bit. The Post had a firm policy that its reporters were never to misrepresent themselves. But he didn't tell Mrs. Segretti he worked for the Washington Post. When he left his name and numbers, they were for both his and Woodward's apartments. Bernstein neglected to tell Woodward about the call. Woodward was playing Scrabble with a friend at his apartment when the phone rang that afternoon. "Is Carl Bernstein there?" Woodward said Bernstein wasn't there and asked who was calling. "Don Segretti." Woodward froze. Why was Segretti calling Bernstein at his place? Bernstein had mentioned only the highlights of his conversation with Shipley. Woodward wasn't familiar enough with the details to put much pressure on. After a long pause, Woodward said, "Oh." "Who is Carl Bernstein?" Segretti asked. Woodward sensed he was trapped and tried to recover him. Both of them were reporters for the Washington Post, he said, and, without letting Segretti get in a word, added that they wanted to ask him about some rather serious allegations involving political undercover work he had done for the Nixon campaign. "The Washington Post?" Segretti asked. He said he didn't know what Woodward was talking about. Besides, he was too busy to talk, he said, and hung up. Woodward called Bernstein at the office and asked what the hell was going on. Bernstein was furious with himself. They had lost the edge. Bernstein and Woodward tried to figure out what to do next. One of them, or another reporter, should get on Segretti's tail right away. They called Sussman at home. He suggested using the Post's West Coast correspondent or a stringer recommended by the National Desk. Robert Myers, a 29-year-old former Newsweek stringer, a term for a reporter hired by a newspaper for several assignments on a story-by-story basis, would track down Segretti. Myers projected an image more professorial than reporter-like, pipe-smoking, a wispy goatee, rimless eyeglasses. When Bernstein reached him at home, he was soaking in the bathtub. He had followed the Post's Watergate coverage closely, and Bernstein brought him up to date on Segretti. There were two other calls that afternoon. A woman at the Georgetown Inn was prevailed upon to search the hotel's records for the week of June 21st, 1971, for a record of Donald Segretti or Bill Mooney. The other call was to Gordon Liddy's home. Bernstein went into an unoccupied office near the newsroom. He was really going to break the rules this time, and he didn't want Bradley or anybody else to walk by his desk and hear him doing it. Besides, there was no question about the security of that phone. He closed the door and rehearsed his number. "Gordon, this is Don Segretti. I think we've got big troubles." All he wanted was some sign of recognition, something like, "What's the problem, Don?" Unfortunately, Bernstein hadn't designed a scenario to deal with the possibility that Mrs. Liddy would answer the phone and ask who was calling. If Mrs. Liddy had ever heard of Donald Segretti, she gave no indication. And if her husband did know Segretti, he would probably phone him in California and find out the caller had been an imposter, probably from the Washington Post, whose reporters had also been in touch with Segretti and his family earlier in the day. Bernstein got off the phone in a hurry. All the lines were out. The next call, Monday afternoon, from the Georgetown Inn, confirmed that Donald H. Segretti had registered on June 25, 1971, and checked out on the 27th. There was no record of the phone calls he had made. Bernstein renewed a contact made in June, when he had been retracing the movements of the five men arrested inside the Watergate. He had called an employee of a credit card company who, if promised anonymity, said he could obtain selected records. A credit card leaves a trail of hotel and restaurant charges and airplane tickets giving dates, times, places, costs, transactions. The FBI usually goes to those records first, gobbling them up with subpoenas. Segretti, whose last name means secrets in Italian, had crisscrossed the country more than 10 times during the last half of 1971, according to his credit card records, usually staying in a city for no longer than a night or two. The stops had included Miami, Houston, Manchester, New Hampshire, Knoxville, Los Angeles, Chicago, Portland, San Francisco, New York, Fresno, Tucson, Albuquerque, and, repeatedly, Washington. Many of the cities were in key political states for the 1972 presidential campaign, mostly primary states. In New Hampshire, Florida, Illinois, and particularly California, Segretti had moved from city to city, leaving his trail in territories where the Democratic primaries would be fought hardest. The travel records supported Shipley's account. Bernstein passed the reporter's information about Segretti on to Myers, who was staking out Segretti's apartment and talking to his neighbors. Marina Del Rey, where Segretti lived, was on the water and, if you believed the ads, represented the ultimate in swinging singles living. Lots of sailing, saunas, mixed doubles tennis, pools, parties, candlelight, long-stemmed glasses, Caesar salads, tanned bodies, mixed double, triple, multiple kinkiness in scented sandalwood splendor. Myers climbed up to Segretti's balcony and looked inside. There were dirty dishes on a counter. The apartment looked comfortable, thick, white wall-to-wall carpeting, a gas jet fireplace with fake logs, a battery of stereo equipment, books, magazines, and records stacked on tables. Myers could see a 10-speed bicycle in a hallway that appeared to lead to the bedroom. Two of Segretti's neighbors said he had left in a hurry in his white Mercedes sports coupe on Saturday afternoon and had mentioned that he might not be back for a few days. They didn't know about his work, except that he was a lawyer and traveled a lot. He didn't talk about politics much. The garage under Segretti's building resembled something between a sports car showroom and a racetrack pit stop. Somebody seemed to be working on a car at almost any hour of the day or night. Myers spent a lot of time in the garage, checking there for Segretti's 280SL, inspecting the vacant parking space for oil drippings, in case he had missed a quick return. But the floor remained dry. The mail in Segretti's mailbox accumulated. On Thursday morning, a matchstick Myers had wedged into the interface of Segretti's front door had dropped to the floor. But there was no answer when Myers knocked, and Segretti's car was not in the garage. Myers waited. Segretti was back that afternoon and answered the door. Myers introduced himself as a reporter for the Post. The Post had information about certain work Segretti had done in behalf of Teddy Kennedy, or possibly Hubert Humphrey, he said. Could they talk? Segretti remained silent in the doorway. He looked younger than his 31 years, more as if he were in his early or mid-20s. He had a friendly face, though it was unsmiling. Myers asked if he had any connection with Kennedy or Humphrey. No. Myers wanted to get inside. The Post had extensive information on Segretti, he said, about his work in the Democratic primaries. Segretti led him inside. Did he know Alex Shipley? Why? Because the Post had information connecting Segretti with an attempt to recruit Shipley for undercover political work. I don't believe it, Segretti said. In fact, hadn't Segretti attempted to recruit Shipley during a drive to Dulles Airport on June 27, 1971, to do work concerning the primary campaign of Humphrey or Muskie? I don't remember. Did he know Alex Shipley? No comment. Hadn't he called Shipley from Chicago and told him he wanted to talk to him about a job? I don't remember. And later, hadn't he called Shipley and asked him to fly to Atlanta to recruit Kenneth Griffiths? I don't remember. He did know Shipley, correct? No comment. Had he called Shipley from California on October 23rd, asking him to check on Muskie's operation in Tennessee? Segretti's demeanor remained mild, even affable. This is ridiculous, he told Myers. I don't know anything about this. This all sounds like James Bond fiction. Myers asked him about Dixon, Nixt, and whether the Treasury Department had picked up any of his tabs, about his law practice, and about his travels, and again about Shipley. Segretti remained impassive, a faint smile on his face. What about the name Bill Mooney, a false ID that Segretti had said he might use? Did that ring a bell? Ridiculous. Segretti moved toward the door. Reaching for a 35mm camera under the back of his jacket, Myers said he wanted to take a picture before he left and started clicking. Segretti ran outside into the hallway, yelling, "No pictures!" A moment later he came back and Myers pointed the lens at his head. "Just one more," Myers said, aiming the camera again. Segretti tried to grab it and missed, then seized Myers' left arm and pushed him toward the open door, the camera still clicking. Myers rushed to a payphone. Bernstein was talking to Sussman in the city editor's office. Things were breaking. During a routine telephone check with a Justice Department official that morning, Bernstein had asked if the official had ever heard of Donald Segretti. It had been a throwaway question. "I can't answer your question because that's part of the investigation," the justice official replied. Bernstein was startled. Woodward and he had thought they were alone in pursuing Segretti. There could be no discussion of Segretti because he was part of the Watergate investigation, right? That was correct. But the official wouldn't listen to any more questions about Segretti. Bernstein went down his list of checks, crossing out each item, writing no or nothing in the margin. "Herbert W. Kalmbach." "That's part of the investigation, too, so I can't talk about it," the official said. Sloan had refused to say if Kalmbach was among those who could give out money from Maurice Stanza's safe. But since the fund was intended for intelligence gathering, Segretti might have been bankrolled that way. Shipley had the impression that Segretti had got money from a big spender who was not in the government. That would fit Kalmbach, President Nixon's personal attorney. Was there a connection between Segretti and Kalmbach? The official would say nothing more. Sussman and Bernstein were discussing all this when a copy aide rushed into the city editor's office to say Myers was waiting on the phone, sounding all out of breath. "Jesus, I know they got my ass beaten trying to take pictures," he told Bernstein. None of them came out. His camera had been incorrectly loaded. Then he got his breath back and put the scene into better focus. Bernstein told Myers that the feds knew about Segretti. Sussman came over to talk to Myers. All agreed he should go back and contact anyone who might know Segretti, find out if his acquaintances had been contacted by the FBI, what questions had been asked, everything they might know about him. The University of Southern California and Bold Hall Law School at Berkeley, where Segretti had studied, seemed the best places. The next day, Myers called to say that, as a USC undergraduate, Segretti had been close to several persons who were to become part of the Nixon White House. Among the USC graduates at the White House were Ron Ziegler, the president's press secretary, Dwight Chapin, the presidential appointment secretary, Bart Porter, a former White House advance man and CRP scheduling director who had received money from the fund, Tim Elborn, who had served as a Ziegler press assistant, Mike Guin, a member of Henry Kissinger's National Security Council staff, and Gordon Strachan, Haldeman's political aide and the White House liaison to CRP. Bernstein and Woodward sent feelers out through the Post newsroom, looking for anyone who had more than superficial contact with members of the White House staff. Their expectations weren't very high, given the relationship between the Nixon administration and the Washington Post. That heady era of good feeling, in which reporters had rubbed elbows and shoulders with President Kennedy's men in touch football and candlelit backyards in Georgetown and Cleveland Park, was a thing of the past. But Carolyn Barker, a former UPI reporter who had joined the city staff on the same day as Woodward, said a friend of hers had gone to USC with the White House boys and had stayed in close touch with them. Within a few hours, Barker had given Bernstein a memo headed, "Notes on USC Crowd." Her friend had known Segretti, Chapin, and Tim Elborn since college. He referred to the USC Mafia in the White House and said Segretti and Elborn had been called by their schoolmates Dwight Chapin and Ron Ziegler to help in the Nixon election business. All belonged to a campus political party called Trojans for Representative Government. The Trojans called their brand of electioneering rat-fucking. Ballot boxes were stuffed, spies were planted in the opposition camp, and bogus campaign literature abounded. Ziegler and Chapin had hooked into Richard Nixon's 1962 campaign for governor of California, managed by Bob Haldeman. After graduation, Ziegler and Chapin and Elborn had joined the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency in Los Angeles, where Haldeman was a vice president. Segretti had been summoned to Washington and trained to work in a presidential election, according to Carolyn Barker's friend. Bernstein called the Justice Department official who had originally told him that Segretti was part of the Watergate investigation. It was Saturday, October 7th. "No, I can't talk about him," the official said once more. "That's right, even though he's not directly linked to Watergate, to the break-in. Obviously, I came across him through the investigation. Yes, political sabotage is associated with Segretti. I've heard a term for it, rat-fucking. There is some very powerful information, especially if it comes out before November 7th, the day of the election." Could that powerful information involve Dwight Chapin? Had he hired Segretti? Or had Ziegler? Or, "I won't say anything on either Ziegler or Chapin." Bernstein guessed Chapin. The official said he certainly didn't want to discourage anything the Post might be pursuing. In the rough code they had evolved, Bernstein interpreted the remark as confirming that there was a connection between Segretti and Chapin. Did Segretti have anything to do with the Canuck letter? The official said he couldn't talk about that letter either. It was also part of the investigation. The so-called Canuck letter had been the beginning of the end of the Muskie campaign, as far as some of the senator's campaign aides were concerned. On February 24th, 2 days before Muskie was scheduled to campaign in Manchester, New Hampshire, William Loeb's right-wing newspaper, The Manchester Union Leader, had published an anti-Muskie editorial on its front page. Titled, Senator Muskie Insults Franco-Americans, it accused Muskie of hypocrisy for supporting blacks while condoning the term Canucks, a derogatory name for Americans of French-Canadian ancestry, tens of thousands of whom were New Hampshire voters. The evidence was a semi-literate letter ostensibly mailed to Loeb from Deerfield Beach, Florida, and published in the Union Leader the same day as the editorial. The signer claimed that a Muskie campaign aide at a Fort Lauderdale meeting had said that, "We don't have blacks, but we have Canucks." And the senator reportedly concurred, laughingly, saying, "Come to New England and see." The Muskie campaign had contended that the letter was a fake and had undertaken an investigation but failed to find the author. On February 25th, Loeb had reprinted a 2-month-old Newsweek item about the senator's wife. Titled Big Daddy's Jane, it reported she sneak-smoked, drank, and used off-color language on the press plane. The next morning, standing in a near blizzard on the back of a flatbed truck, Muskie had abandoned his prepared text and attacked Loeb as a gutless coward. Then, while defending his wife, he broke down and cried. There was no dispute among Muskie's backers, his opponents, and the press that the incident had a disastrous effect on his campaign. It shattered the calm, cool, reasoned image that was basic to Muskie's voter appeal and focused the last-minute attention of New Hampshire voters on the alleged slur against the French Canadians, who would be a formidable minority of voters in the Democratic primary. Bernstein groped through the paper effluvia on his desk and retrieved a manila file marked phones. In June, he had begun jotting down phone numbers of persons contacted on the story, logging them on a sheet of copy paper. He started going through the pages, looking for people who might know about Donald Segretti, rat-fucking, Dwight Chapin, the USC Mafia, and the Canuck letter. Bernstein had been reading the clippings on the primaries for any examples of malicious, dirty tricks. Finally, he hit with one call. Rat-fucking! The word struck a raw nerve with a Justice Department attorney. You can go right to the top on that one. I was shocked when I learned about it. I couldn't believe it. These are public servants. God, it's nauseating. You're talking about fellows who come from the best schools in the country, men who run the government. Bernstein wondered what right to the top meant, but he wasn't given time to ask. The attorney had worked himself into a rage. If the Justice Department could find a law against it, a jury of laymen would convict them on that. It's absolutely despicable. Segretti, he's indescribable. It would be useful for you to write an article about this type of conduct. I was so shocked. I didn't understand it. It's completely immoral. All these people, unbelievable. Look at Hunt. I don't think he's involved in the rat-fucking, but he's capable of anything. And he had access to the White House. The press hasn't brought that home. You're dealing with people who act like this was Dodge City, not the capital of the United States. Hunt bringing guns into the White House. There had been news stories reporting that the FBI had found a gun in Howard Hunt's White House office. Bernstein was impressed. He had never known the man to be so outraged. The Chapin-Segretti connection? Look at it more to see if your facts are straight, the attorney advised. The secret fund, had it financed the rat-fucking? That's a fruitful area. He was calm for a moment, then became angry again. Why else would they have all that money lying around? It's a scandal, but it will all come out at the trial. The Canuck letter? The Muskie letter is part of it. Comback? I won't discuss names. There are so many things that nothing would surprise me. It'll come out of the trial, which is the best context of all, because the people will know it is the truth. The prosecutors have the truth. They want an opportunity to show it. The people who did this are going to take the stand. John Mitchell? Mitchell. They won't call him. But it will be there. He can't say he didn't know about it because it was strategy. Basic strategy that goes all the way to the top. Higher than him, even. The attorney realized he had gone too far. Higher than Mitchell? Dwight Chapin was a functionary, an advance man and glorified valet, servant to Richard Nixon and H.R. Haldeman. At most, there were three persons who went higher than John Mitchell. John Ehrlichman, maybe, Haldeman, and Richard M. Nixon. Basic strategy that goes all the way to the top. The phrase unnerved Bernstein. For the first time, he considered the possibility that the President of the United States was the head ratfucker. When I am the candidate, I run the campaign. Richard Nixon had said that after his aides had botched the management of the 1970 midterm elections. Sitting at his desk, Bernstein remembered the quote and wished Woodward were there, but Woodward had gone to New York for the weekend. After almost 4 months of working together, a kind of spiritual affinity had developed between Woodward and Bernstein. People at the paper would occasionally kid them that they were out to get the president. What if they really had to confront such a situation? Not getting the president, but obtaining persuasive evidence that he was involved. Bernstein tried thinking as Woodward would. What did he have? Three attorneys said they had been approached by Segretti. There was no evidence beyond a Justice Department's lawyer's angry reactions. There were the travel records, circumstantial. There was no evidence that a law had been broken. What they had was ephemeral, but there were enough pieces to try writing something. The rule was, lay it out piece by piece, write what you know is solid, the big picture can wait. Bernstein tried a lead. Three attorneys have told the Washington Post that they were asked to conduct political espionage and sabotage on behalf of President Nixon's re-election campaign by a man who was under FBI investigation in connection with the Watergate bugging incident. The words espionage and sabotage couldn't be lightly chosen. They were war terms. Bernstein and Woodward had talked about that. About the fact that the White House and CRP regarded the president's re-election campaign as a holy war. Bernstein wrote late into the night, came in early on Sunday morning, called Sussman at home. A draft would be ready by midday for Sussman to look at. He arrived about 2, read the draft, then read it over the phone to Woodward in New York. Sussman and Bernstein wanted to run the story. Woodward argued that not enough details about the sabotage operations were known, and that their scope and purposes were unclear. Moreover, the implications shouldn't be hinted at until there was more solid information. Woodward prevailed. He'd catch the next plane to Washington and contact Deep Throat. He left New York on the last Eastern shuttle and, from a telephone booth at National Airport, called Deep Throat at home. They had recently arranged a method by which Woodward could call to request a garage meeting without identifying himself. Woodward put his suitcase in a locker and got a hamburger. He took a cab to a downtown hotel, waited 10 minutes, took another, walked the final stretch, and arrived at the garage at 1:30 a.m. Deep Throat was already there, smoking a cigarette. He was glad to see Woodward, shook his hand. Woodward told him that he and Bernstein needed help, really needed help on this one. His friendship with Deep Throat was genuine, not cultivated. Long before Watergate, they had spent many evenings talking about Washington, the government, power. On evenings such as those, Deep Throat had talked about how politics had infiltrated every corner of government, a strong-arm takeover of the agencies by the Nixon White House. Junior White House aides were giving orders on the highest levels of the bureaucracy. He had once called it the switchblade mentality, and had referred to the willingness of the president's men to fight dirty and for keeps, regardless of what effect the slashing might have on the government and the nation. There was little bitterness on his part. Woodward sensed the resignation of a man whose fight had been worn out in too many battles. Deep Throat never tried to inflate his knowledge or show off his importance. He always told rather less than he knew. Woodward considered him a wise teacher. He was dispassionate and seemed committed to the best version of the obtainable truth. The Nixon White House worried him. "They are all underhanded and unknowable," he had said numerous times. He also distrusted the press. "I don't like newspapers," he had said flatly. He detested inexactitude and shallowness. Aware of his own weaknesses, he readily conceded his flaws. He was, incongruously, an incurable gossip, careful to label rumor for what it was, but fascinated by it. He knew too much literature too well, and let the allurements of the past turn him away from his instincts. He could be rowdy, drink too much, overreach. He was not good at concealing his feelings, hardly ideal for a man in his position. Of late, he had expressed fear for the future of the executive branch, which he was in a unique position to observe. Watergate had taken its toll. Even in the shadows of the garage, Woodward saw that he was thinner, and when he drew on his cigarette, that his eyes were bloodshot. That night, Deep Throat seemed more talkative than usual. "There is a way to untie the Watergate knot," he began. "I can't and won't give you any new names, but everything points in the direction of what was called offensive security. Remember, you don't do those 1,500 FBI interviews and not have something on your hands other than a single break-in." The White House and the Justice Department had cited the number of interviews conducted by the FBI as evidence of the thoroughness of the Watergate investigation. "But please be balanced and send out people to check everything, because a lot of the CRP intelligence gathering was routine. They are not brilliant guys, and it got out of hand," Deep Throat said. That's the key phrase, the feeling that it all got out of hand. Much of the intelligence gathering was on their own campaign contributors, and some to check on the Democratic contributors, to check people out and sort of semi-blackmail them if something was found. A very heavy-handed operation. Deep Throat had access to information from the White House, Justice, the FBI, and CRP. What he knew represented an aggregate of hard information flowing in and out of many stations. Reluctantly, after prodding, he agreed that Woodward and Bernstein were correct about the involvement of higher-ups in the Watergate break-in and other illegal activities as well. "Mitchell?" "Mitchell was involved." "To what extent?" "Only the president and Mitchell know," he said. "Mitchell conducted his own, he called it an investigation, for about 10 days after June 17th. And he was going crazy. He found all sorts of new things which astounded even him. At some point, Howard Hunt, of all the ironies, was assigned to help Mitchell get some information. Like lightning, he was pulled off and fired and told to pack up his desk and leave town forever, by no less than John Ehrlichman." Woodward reacted with equal measures of shock and skepticism. Ehrlichman was the good guy, the resident program man in the White House who dealt with legislation, concepts, domestic crises. Politics was Haldeman's and Mitchell's turf. Woodward pointed out the gravity of Deep Throat's remark that only the president and Mitchell knew, but the man would not elaborate. Woodward asked if the Watergate bugging and spying were isolated, or if they were parts of the same operation as the other activities Deep Throat referred to. "Check every lead," Deep Throat advised. "It goes all over the map, and that's important. You could write stories from now until Christmas, or well beyond that. Not one of the games," his term for undercover operations, "was freelance. This is important. Everyone was tied in." But he wouldn't talk specifically about Segretti's operation. Woodward couldn't understand why. "Just remember what I'm saying. Everything was part of it. Nothing was freelance. I know what I'm talking about." "Rat-fucking?" He had heard the term. It meant double-cross, and, as used by the Nixon forces, it referred to infiltration of the Democrats. Deep Throat returned to Mitchell on his own steam. That guy definitely learned some things in those 10 days after Watergate. He was just sick. And everyone was saying that he was ruined because of what his people did, especially Mardian and LaRue, and what happened at the White House. And Mitchell said if this all comes out, it could ruin the administration. I mean, ruin it. Mitchell realized he was personally ruined and would have to get out. Woodward asked about the White House. There were 4 basic personnel groupings for undercover operations, Deep Throat said. The November group, which handled CRP's advertising. A convention group, which handled intelligence gathering and sabotage planning for both the Republican and Democratic conventions. A primary group, which did the same for the primaries of both parties. And the Howard Hunt group, which was the really heavy operations team. The Howard Hunt group reported to Chuck Colson, who maybe didn't know specifically about the bugging. There's no proof, but Colson was getting daily updates on the activities and the information. He shook his head. There are stories all over town. Check every one. Each is good. What about Martha Mitchell? She knows nothing, apparently, but that doesn't mean she won't talk. He didn't laugh. Deep Throat had said there were games going on all over the map. For instance, I know of intelligence gathering and games in Illinois, New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, California, Texas, Florida, and the District of Columbia. The president's forces had been out to wreck the campaigns of both the Democrats and of Nixon's challengers within his own party, Representative Paul McCloskey of California and Representative John Ashbrook of Ohio. Woodward asked about Howard Hunt and leak plugging at the White House. That operation was not only to check leaks to the papers, but often to manufacture items for the press. It was a Colson-Hunt operation. Recipients include all of you guys, Jack Anderson, Evans and Novak, and the Post and the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. The business of Eagleton's drunk driving record, or his health records, I understand, involves the White House and Hunt somehow. Total manipulation, that was their goal, with everyone eating at one time or another out of their hands. Even the press. Deep Throat confirmed what the reporter's other sources had hinted. The FBI's and the grand jury's investigations had been limited to the Watergate operation, and had ignored other espionage and sabotage. None of the outside games were checked, he said. If it wasn't limited to Watergate proper, they would never have finished, believe me. There was also non-corroborative testimony before the grand jury, driving everyone wild. Certain perjury. Sally Harmony? Sally and others. Deep Throat then issued an explicit warning. They want to single out the Post. They want to go to court to get at your sources. It was 3 a.m. There was more general discussion about the White House, its mood, the war atmosphere. Woodward and Deep Throat sat down on the garage floor. Neither wanted to end the conversation. Their heads and backs rested against the garage wall. Exhaustion loosened them up. Woodward said that he and Bernstein couldn't go much further, that what they had was too vague. Watergate would not expose what the White House had done, not without more specific information. Deep Throat again told Woodward to concentrate on the other games, not the break-in at Democratic headquarters. Still, they needed help, Woodward said. Could they say for certain that the games were White House-sponsored? Of course, of course. Don't you get my message? Deep Throat was exasperated. He stood up. What games? Woodward asked. One couldn't publish stories based on vague references to higher-ups, on information that might or might not have been leaked to the press by Howard Hunt, that the Eagleton records were somehow tied into Hunt and the White House. There's nothing more I can say, Deep Throat replied, and began to walk off. Woodward said that he and Bernstein needed more, something that went beyond generalities. What about the Canuck letter? Deep Throat stopped and turned around. It was a White House operation, done inside the gates surrounding the White House and the executive office building. Is that enough? It wasn't. They needed to know the scope of the intelligence gathering, of the games. Were most of them carried out, or merely planned? Woodward grabbed Deep Throat's arm. The time had come to press the limit. Woodward found himself angry. He told Deep Throat that both of them were playing a chicken shit game. Deep Throat for pretending to himself that he never fed Woodward primary information, and Woodward for chewing up tidbits like a rat under a picnic table that didn't have the guts to go after the main dish. Deep Throat was angry too, but not at Woodward. "Okay," he said softly. "This is very serious. You can safely say that 50 people worked for the White House and CRP to play games and spy and sabotage and gather intelligence. Some of it's beyond belief, kicking at the opposition in every imaginable way. You already know some of it." Deep Throat nodded confirmation as Woodward ran down items on a list of tactics that he and Bernstein had heard were used against the political opposition. Bugging, following people, false press leaks, fake letters, canceling campaign rallies, investigating campaign workers' private lives, planting spies, stealing documents, planting provocateurs in political demonstrations. "It's all in the files," Deep Throat said. "Justice and the Bureau know about it, even though it wasn't followed up." Woodward was stunned. 50 people, directed by the White House and CRP to destroy the opposition, no holds barred? Deep Throat nodded. The White House had been willing to subvert, was that the right word, the whole electoral process? Had actually gone ahead and tried to do it? Another nod. Deep Throat looked queasy. "And hired 50 agents to do it?" "You can safely say more than 50," Deep Throat said. Then he turned, walked up the ramp and out. It was nearly 6 a.m. Chapter 7 Woodward arrived at the office 4 hours later and typed his notes from the meeting with Deep Throat. A carbon was in Bernstein's typewriter when he arrived half an hour later. Woodward, Bernstein, Sussman, and Rosenfeld met briefly. There would be 3 stories. A lead by Bernstein and Woodward outlining the general program of rat-fucking, espionage, and sabotage by at least 50 agents. Bernstein's story on Segretti. An account by Woodward of White House involvement in the Canuck Letter episode. While Woodward was writing the Canuck Letter story, Bernstein was having trouble sketching a general story about the White House-directed espionage and sabotage. There were too many generalizations, and the meaty details were in the other 2 stories. As he often did when he was experiencing difficulty writing, Bernstein walked across the newsroom to the water cooler. Marilyn Berger, a national staff reporter who covers the State Department, came up to him as he scanned the bulletin board. She asked if he and Woodward knew about the Canuck letter. "Sure," he said. "They were writing it for tomorrow." He took another sip before the peculiarity of the question struck him. Woodward had only found out about the Canuck letter at 6 that morning. They were careful in the office not to talk about what they were working on. The only people Bernstein or Woodward had mentioned the letter to were Sussman, Rosenfeld, Simons, Bradley, and David Broder, the Post's senior political reporter. How did Marilyn know about it? "Dave Broder hasn't told you?" she asked. "Told them what?" "That Ken Clausen wrote the Canuck letter?" Marilyn said. Bernstein's reply was loud enough to cause heads to turn in that corner of the newsroom. Berger explained that Clausen, their former colleague on the Post, had told her matter-of-factly over a drink that he had written the Canuck letter. He had said it several times. The coincidence seemed too much. Bernstein suspected a setup. On the same morning they learn that the White House is responsible for the Canuck letter, Marilyn Berger waltzes into the newsroom and says Ken Clausen did it. But Berger said Clausen had told her about it more than 2 weeks earlier, before Bernstein had ever heard of Segretti. Besides, he thought, Clausen was just the kind who would think nothing of pulling such a trick. Bernstein tugged Berger by the arm and asked her to repeat to Woodward what she had said. Woodward had some doubts that Clausen would get involved in dirty tricks for the White House so soon after leaving the post for the president's staff. The Canuck letter had been printed less than 3 weeks after Clausen had joined the administration. Woodward raised the point, then he remembered something. A friend at the White House had once told